This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. The mayor of a super wealthy Swiss municipality that has 300 millionaires among its 2,000 residents is unwilling to let in 10 Syrian refugees past its borders. Mayor Andreas Glarner would rather pay a $300,000 annual fine then allow a handful of brown-skinned refugees fleeing war into his uber-elite enclave. There are more people fleeing their homes today than at any other time in modern history. Yet, most of our leaders and officials seem to not know how to best respond. The global refugee crisis is creating a serious moral challenge for world leaders, one that we will attempt to clarify today with my guest, Sasha Chainoff. He is the founder and executive director of the group Refuge Point and the co-author of the book From Crisis to Calling, Finding Your Moral Center in the Toughest Decisions. Welcome to the program, Sasha.
Thanks, Sonali. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, tell us about your background and experience in terms of refugee crises. The world has, in various regions of the world, have at various times experienced massive exoduses because of various political reasons. And you found yourself many years ago in the Congo. What manner of experience did you get in the Congo? What were you there to do? And can you share with us a sort of brief story of your experience there?
Yeah, I'd love to. Thanks for the question. So Congo, Democratic Republic of Congo, is a country that's rich in terms of diversity and culture and opportunities, but it's also a country that's been riven by terrible violence for the past two decades. And after the Rwandan genocide a few years later, the Congolese president actually announced that people of the Tutsi tribe in the Congo are the enemy and needed to be hunted down and exterminated. The U.S. government, in response to this proclamation and the violence that ensued, contracted the organization that I was working with at the time, the International Organization for Migration, to send small rescue teams into the Congo to evacuate people who had survived massacres. Those evacuations brought out about 1,500 people who eventually all came to the U.S. But on the last rescue mission, 112 survivors of massacres were held back by the Congolese government. They were in a safe, protected compound outside of Congo's capital. And my boss, David Derthick, who orchestrated this operation, said that the mission is done. Congolese government won't let us come and get those people. They will most likely perish there, but we can't do anything about it. The U.S. put pressure on the Congolese government, and they said we can come in and get those 112 people. So my boss handed me a list with 112 names on it in our office in Nairobi, Kenya, where we were working, and said, I want you to go in and evacuate these 112 people. Under no circumstances are you to take anybody else on your evacuation flight, because if you do, Congolese officials may try to include their own people, and then they'll hold yours back, and you won't get anybody out, and the people there will perish. And he said, I'm sending my right-hand woman in with you. She's been on every evacuation with me previously. This is a woman named Sheikha Ali, a Kenyan woman. And he said, you can follow her lead. She knows what to do. I had never been in the Congo before, but this woman, Sheikha, had. But my boss, David, said, she may try to include other people, and you have to stop her if she tries. She can't deny herself when she sees people in need. So Sheikha and I flew into the Congo and rented a car and a driver and went to this safe, protected compound where these 112 people had gathered. And we met them there, but then as we were trying to leave that compound, someone working there said, you have to go into a tent over there and see a new group of people that just came in. And I said, we can't go into a tent. We can't look at anybody else. Our list is closed. Our evacuation is closed. But my colleague Sheikha said, Sasha, we have to go in and look. And she walked towards the tent. And then I found my feet following her. And I stepped inside that tent. In that tent were 32 widows and orphans who had been put in a prison camp simply because they were the wrong tribe in the wrong place. They had done nothing wrong. But many of their family members had been executed in this prison camp. And they looked traumatized and barely alive. We leaned over to a little girl holding a doll and said, what's your doll's name? And all of a sudden the doll's eyes popped open and we realized that it was a tiny infant that looked more dead than alive. Sheikha and I left that tent, and that night at our hotel base, we started arguing. And she said, Sasha, we have to include these people on our list. And I said, I know, but if we do, we're risking all the lives of the people who are on our list that we know we can get out. And I had specific instructions not to take anybody. She finally, after many hours, said, Sasha, we're humanitarians. We're on the ground here. This decision is up to us. If we don't do this, these people will die here. We're the ones who need to make the decision. And she finally convinced me. This is what I wanted to do too. We called our boss, and he told us that if we could get the U.S. ambassador's approval, we could try it. We did, and we managed to evacuate all those people. It was a hair-raising situation at the airport when the Congolese officials tried to stop us, but they finally let us go. That experience for me opened my eyes to refugees who were off the radar, who had fled crises and violence, but who didn't have anybody to support them. And when I worked across Africa subsequently, I found situation after situation like that. For example, in Kenya's Kakuma camp, when I was working on the resettlement of a group known as the Sudanese Lost Boys, I found many girls there who had the same exact story of flight and persecution as the boys, but who were overlooked. These experiences led me to start Refuge Point, an organization that finds lasting solutions for the world's most at-risk refugees.
So what it sounds like to me was a turning point for you when you realized that faced with other human beings just like you, who just had less power than you, and you had the power to do something about it, that you found that you had to do the right thing. And sadly, across history, we've had many instances where people have gone along with following orders. And yet we've also had people who have defied orders and done heroic things because they've been moved by their own sort of humanity. So is it a sort of either or situation? I mean, most situations we find ourselves in aren't simply black and white, right? I mean, European leaders might argue that today's refugee crisis emanating from Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan is something that they cannot, you know, simply take an easy position on because there's all these factors involved, like money and resources, and if they open the door, then more will come, etc. These are difficult questions, aren't they?
Oh, they certainly are. And a host of factors come up when you're confronted with very difficult situations. But what I've found, and what the book From Crisis to Calling that I just co-authored talks about, is the need to consult yourself and your own sense of compassion and empathy when making these decisions. Not that that's the only factor, but if you overlook that perspective of yourself, you're overlooking something that's very basic and intrinsic in all of us. What we're seeing right now globally is that refugees have become pawns. They are bargaining chips. People are paying money to keep them out of their countries. What we need to do is recognize that we are facing a new crisis in the world that is of unprecedented proportions. We have to confront this crisis with humanity, with empathy, and with understanding, and we have to create migration channels that make sense, migration channels that are formalized, that people can access. One of the reasons we saw so many Syrians trying to get into Europe starting last year in September is because the world has run out of money. In the year 2000, about $2 billion was spent on humanitarian aid. In 2014, about $25 billion was spent on humanitarian aid, and that was not nearly enough. Food rations for about 800,000 Syrians were cut overnight, and this forced people into dangerous choices of watching their children starve or risking their lives on the open seas. We see, though, that Syria is not the only crisis. You mentioned that there are about 60 million refugees and people forcibly displaced from their homes today. These are people from Africa, from across the world, and in fact, more people have lost their lives trying to cross the Mediterranean from Africa. Even last Friday, we had 112 or so bodies that washed up on the Libyan coast. So this is not just a Middle Eastern crisis. This is a global crisis that we have to confront with compassion and empathy and understanding, and not think that we can't allow these people in. We actually see everywhere that refugees are assets. When you allow them to contribute to society, they bring tremendous resources to bear. We've seen that they help to start businesses. Here in the U.S., I've seen refugee populations that regenerate depressed areas of cities from St. Louis, Maine to from Lewiston, Maine to Missouri and other states around the country.
I mean, this story that I opened our interview with about the Swiss mayor to me was just such a symbolic story of how we see this very sharp divide between the haves and have-nots. The Swiss mayor basically wanting to surround his tiny little town of 2,000 residents with barbed wire and saying that, I think that we need to help people closer to their homes so that they stay there and don't disrupt our perfect way of life. 300 millionaires living among these 2,000 people in this tiny little Swiss enclave. And of course, they would rather pay the money than let people in because they're the ones who have money. What advice would you give Mayor Andreas Glarner?
He should sit down and meet with refugees himself. The kind of political rhetoric that we're hearing there and across Europe, and even here in the US, is so dangerous and counterproductive and actually increases problems in the world. I worked in that rescue operation under the Clinton administration, and that administration was devoted to these values, humanitarian and moral values that helped to elevate the US government's leadership in this world. When I worked with the Sudanese Lost Boys, that was under the Bush administration. So we see that both Democratic and Republican administrations here in the US have been committed to moral values and protecting others. We're at a global moment in terms of who we are
I
as a
need to
nation.
just actually interrupt you there. I mean, doesn't it seem as though the United States, first of all, has been a huge part of the problem in creating the crisis? So many of the refugees are from Iraq and Afghanistan today. I mean, I know you mentioned Africa, but countries where we have fought wars have had some of the worst refugee crises, or been part of the problem. And even President Obama, for the refugees on our doorstep from Central America that are coming in, has ended up, been more interested in imprisoning refugees in detention centers than actually helping resettle them. Hillary Clinton, very deeply involved in the coup in Honduras that helped create the Central American refugee crisis, she thinks that we should simply deport little children. Isn't, you know, so what do you make of that? I mean, shouldn't we apply the same standards of humanitarianism to the refugees at our own doorstep?
We absolutely must do that. And our government right now has done very many positive things and has been criticized for many things as well. But we have to have a core perspective of empathy and compassion. It's what I talk about in this book. It's what makes us human. But it also actually increases our leadership stance in the world when we open our doors, when we enable people to have a pathway to safety and a new life. It's what our nation was founded on. And when I meet refugees and see how they rebuild their lives here, there's no doubt that they are assets. One of the young children that I met in that tent in the Congo was a 15-year-old boy who had been so traumatized by the violence that he'd seen and the torture that he'd undergone that he was mute. He did not talk. He came here to the US. He actually found that running in high school started to help him feel less traumatized, and he became a national running champion in college. He's now getting a master's degree. He now teaches others. He does inspirational speaking. So we see that when we provide people with pathways to safety and a new life, ultimately they enrich us. So we have to face these crises with a moral perspective of understanding who they are and understanding that we could be in a similar situation. Myself and so many others could be in a similar situation. In fact, my own family came here as refugees 100 years ago. So this is part of our nation's history to welcome people, and we have to find ways to do that more effectively.
Now, there is certainly something to be said for addressing the causes of refugee crises in the first place, right? I mean, we know, for example, climate change is going to be a huge driver of people fleeing all over the world, wars, income inequality. And of course, as somebody who works with refugees, you're mired in solutions for refugees, but also shouldn't we be discussing how to address the causes that create refugee crises in the first place? Most people would rather live and grow up and spend their lives in their own countries if those countries were places that had the same resources and justice and access to proper, clothing, health, et cetera, as those of us here in the West do.
Absolutely. And the fact is that any person who's a refugee, the first thing they want to do is go home. The US government brought in Kosovo refugees in 1997, 1998. That was an extraordinary airlift operation of Muslim refugees coming to the US. It was tremendously successful. Many of those people stayed here and rebuilt their lives. But when things calmed down in Kosovo, so many went home. So we provided people with safety and an opportunity to rebuild their lives.
And I should also
Yes.
add,
These
Bill Clinton oversaw the bombing of Yugoslavia that had a lot to do with the refugee crisis, too. So our leaders are part of the problem in creating the horrible crises.
and these also need political solutions. We cannot think that humanitarian band-aids will address what is at root political problems. And that means that governments around the world have to unite along with the warring factions in Syria to figure out how we can bring war to a close. But what we also have to do as a global community is start thinking about humanitarian aid in a different way. Since World War II, our approach to refugees has been to provide people with emergency temporary service until they can return home. But the fact is that today, beyond the scope of the crisis, we also see that the average amount of time someone is a refugee is nearing 20 years. People no longer go home, and there is not the humanitarian aid system is broke. And it's broken. There's no money to even feed people adequately. And that's what's spurring all these people to try to find safety in other places. But also, it's broken in the sense that we have to stop just giving emergency aid. That's necessary at the outset of a crisis. But we have to transition into looking at how refugees, people who fled war and conflict, can become self-reliant, can support themselves so that they don't need aid anymore, so that they can contribute to the communities to which they've fled. And we find that when refugees do have an opportunity to contribute to their communities, they start businesses, they become leaders, they inspire others around them. So the whole humanitarian focus has to shift from emergency aid to looking at long-term opportunities for people to establish themselves. This is one of the areas that Refuge Point, the organization that I founded, is focused on. It's how do we enable refugees to become self-reliant? And for those who can't, for those who are so in danger that they will not survive where they are, we have to increase migration channels so that more people can resettle to the US, Canada, Australia, and countries around the world.
And actually, this is a good question. President Obama has said that the U.S. is willing to accept 10,000 Syrian refugees. This is a teeny tiny number compared to those that are actually fleeing. And yet, I understand only about 1,000 or so have made it to the U.S. Why is that? Is that the U.S. isn't, obviously, it's harder to physically cross an ocean in addition to this Mediterranean Sea to get to the U.S. Is there something that the U.S. could be doing better to fulfill its promise of resettling 10,000 refugees?
Sonali, it's a great question. And the answer is absolutely yes. The US government has many different security checks, which are necessary for anybody coming here. Our US resettlement program is actually the most secure way of the millions of people coming to the US that anyone will arrive here because there are so many different security checks. But these can be streamlined in a way so that it does not take an average of 2 to 3 years for somebody who needs a life-saving emergency resettlement, a child or an orphan or a widow to come here. So we need to update and renovate our refugee resettlement program so that it is streamlined. We know the people that we're identifying. The people are handpicked by experts in this field, and they go through extensive interviews with multiple US agencies and extensive security checks and exams, and we can do this faster and better, and we must. And so that 10,000, hopefully we will reach that and we will increase that. We actually see that the US government traditionally has had about 70 to 75,000 resettlement spaces available every year, and yet every year, tens of thousands of those slots were going unused, which is actually one of the reasons that Refuge Point started, so we could help to make sure that we'd identify refugees in life-threatening situations who would have access to those slots.
And
In
doesn't some of that have
2013,
to do with how we define a refugee? For example, the Central Americans fleeing war and poverty and violence in their countries are classified as immigrants rather than refugees. But many organizations see that they are really refugees. I mean, they ought to be eligible for these spots that are going unused instead of occupying spots in detention centers, right?
Absolutely. And for people who are arriving here in the US, they need to go through logical asylum interviews and then have access to the same procedures that everybody else
Right.
has. So these are people who are getting into the US and then go through an asylum process here. And that asylum process helps to define if that person is actually fleeing persecution. We've seen that our government does things positively and negatively. In the 1980s, we actually did not recognize a lot of Central American refugees as refugees for political reasons, even though they were fleeing violence. And that actually started the whole sanctuary movement, where people across
Right.
America, starting with actually conservatives in Texas and Arizona, helped to create the sanctuary movement to receive people here because they disagreed with how our government was doing things. These people are refugees, they are deserving of asylum. But then across the world, we have to reach others as well. And we're doing that. So what I was about to say was that we have increased our numbers to 85,000. Next year, we will increase them again. President Obama is going to speak at a summit on September 20th in New York, where he will talk about the need globally to increase resettlement and to make sure that we are providing adequate protection for those people in life-threatening situations.
And so finally, can you briefly outline the multi-step process by which you advise leaders to meet the moral challenge of refugees in your book, From Crisis to Calling?
So what happened was with the decision that I faced, that life and death decision about including this group of 32 widows and orphans, and that would risk other people's lives or leaving those people there. I realized that it was kind of a five-step process that is actually quite universal and is applicable to others. And that process includes being prepared. We have to be ready for the fact that we will face decisions, not necessarily the same kind of decision I faced, but people, you will be faced with a decision that impacts other people in a significant way. Be ready for that, because if you're not ready, you might overlook it. And once you're ready, another principle is to open your eyes to it. When I stepped into that tent, I opened my eyes to the fact that there were widows and orphans there, and I saw them myself. But seeing people is often not enough. Then my colleague Sheikha and I argued, and a third principle is to confront yourself. She helped me to confront myself and to make me think about who I was as an individual and what experiences did I have and what was my internal moral compass telling me to do. The fourth principle is to know yourself, to understand your own experiences and your background and what in your deepest heart you should do. But even with those four principles, it might be hard to make a decision where you might be putting yourself at risk or there might be other consequences. So the fifth principle is to take courage. Take courage to do what you know is the right thing. And in this book, we bring in other leaders from the military, from the health profession, from the humanitarian space, and others who share their own stories of decision points that have helped to guide them and have helped to influence their lives after they understood their rock bottom values. So that's what the book is about. It's really exciting. I'm excited that it's finally come out on the bookshelves and people can get it on Amazon or in the local bookstore as well, From Crisis to Calling.
Sasha, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Would you like to give out a website for Refuge Point?
Refuge Point is our humanitarian organization that finds lasting solutions for the world's most vulnerable refugees, and we are at www.refugepoint.org.
Thank you so much, and best of luck to you.
Thanks so much, Sonali.
Sasha Chainoff is the founder and executive director of the group Refuge Point, and he's also the lead author of the book From Crisis to Calling, Finding Your Moral Center in the Toughest Decisions. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.